Guess what, Will?
What's that, Mango?
I've been trying to write a promo for our podcast, Part-Time Genius, but even though we've done over 250 episodes, we don't really talk about murders or cults.
I mean, we did just cover the Illuminati of cheese, so I feel like that makes us pretty edgy. We also solve mysteries like how Chinese is your Chinese food and how do dollar stores make money? And then, of course, can you game a dog show?
So what you're saying is everyone should be listening.
Listen to Part-Time Genius on the iHeartRadio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Big Take from Bloomberg News brings you what's shaping the world's economies with the smartest and best-informed business reporters around the world.
We cover the stories behind what's moving money and markets and help you understand what's happening, what it means, and why it matters every afternoon. I'm Sarah Holder.
I'm Saleha Mohsen.
And I'm David Gura. Listen to The Big Take on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Rachel Zoe here, and we're going back to the Rachel Zoe Project for a very special takeover on my podcast, Climbing in Heels. Come with me as I take you back to season one to give you all the behind-the-scenes details and drama. I'll be joined by some special guests that'll be helping me share the real stories behind the most iconic moments in the show. So do not miss this special takeover of Climbing in Heels. It's going to be bananas. Listen to Climbing in Heels with Rachel Zoe on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, and wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind, a production of iHeartRadio.
Hey, welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind. My name is Robert Lamb.
And I'm Joe McCormick, and we're back with part two in our series on headless gods and monsters. This is a topic that we had talked about getting into for the Halloween season, but we never got around to it. So here we are, turning things in late. So in part one, we talked about the biological origins of the bileterian head and about what factors probably drove our ancestors hundreds of millions of years ago to start concentrating nerve cells and sense organs and mouth parts all on one end of the body. And of course, this is the development that would eventually turn into our faces and our brains. We also talked about stories of gods with no heads from cultures around the world. And today we're back to talk about some more headless ghosts, monsters, and dubious historical claims of people who naturally have no heads or have heads located inside their torsos.
Yeah, as we discussed in the last episode, no matter what direction you approach the topic from, it ends up being clear that, like, this idea of something without a head, it captivates us. It forces us to think and rethink various ideas about, like, what a person is, what an entity is, where volition comes from, and so forth. So, yeah, getting here into the idea of, roughly speaking, the diabolical headless, there are any number of headless monsters and ghosts in global traditions. We're probably not going to cover, we're definitely not going to cover all of them. We may leave out by error some key examples. And so if we do skip such a headless entity from folklore, mythology, write in. We'd love to hear from you. Especially if it's a situation where head and or body continue to live on afterwards. I guess you could roughly throw Medusa into that category, though we did a whole series on Medusa back in the day. So refer back to those if you want to hear about Medusa's head. I think it's also, I think fair that we might presume that a lot of these different ideas have to do with, at least in, concerning some of like the ghosts we're going to be talking about and so forth, taboos against the burial of incomplete remains, also thoughts about beheading as a form of execution. So keeping all that in mind, I thought we'd bring up the first one here. And this is a pretty big one, especially when we start thinking about things like the Headless Horseman from the Legend of Sleepy Hollow. We have a creature from the Scottish Highlands. The name means the headless trunk. And I'm probably going to butcher the pronunciation here, but Colun Gun Chen. It's said to haunt the Isle of Skye, and it leaves women and children alone, but if it happens upon a male traveler at night, especially anyone who's out there on their own, well, then it's going to brutally attack. In Dictionary of Celtic Mythology, James MacKillop describes it as a form of boken or hobgoblin, He writes that it's often thought of as a tutelary or protector spirit of the MacDonalds of Morar in the Western Highlands.
Is there a commonly understood explanation of why this ghost is headless, or is it just kind of that's the way it is?
I'm not aware of a particular origin story here, but I could be missing something. By the way, he also writes of the Irish death coach and points out that the driver and or the horses are sometimes described as headless. And indeed, sometimes it was called the headless coach, and it is sometimes driven by the headless phantom, Dullahan.
Dullahan.
Yeah. So the Dullahan is the headless horseman of Irish folklore. And this one is, I think, often held up as the clear inspiration for the headless horseman of Sleepy Hollow. McCullough describes it as indeed often riding a headless horse or driving the coach that we already mentioned. And sometimes that coach is made out of bones. There are a number of grisly details regarding the coach that sometimes are left out of retellings. It actually does have a ghoulish head that has been removed from its body, described as a great chunk of moldy cheese with darting eyes.
Wow, that is evocative.
Yeah, so, I mean, it makes it sound like, okay, the head is definitely dead, I guess. But again, supernatural being, so I guess anything is fair game. The Dullahan is said to take this moldy cheese head off for shock and may throw it around like a ball. So one can imagine, you know, sort of like bouncing it off the shoulders or something, or dribbling it like a basketball.
Oh, this reminds me of something I read that I couldn't find a great source for this, but allegedly the ghost of the English Archbishop William Laud, who is believed to haunt St. John's College in Oxfordshire, is said to sometimes either kick his head around like a soccer ball or bowl with his own head. But like I said, I couldn't find a great looking source for that, but that is a claim I've read attested.
I mean, the human imagination just can't help but go there, right?
Yeah.
Now, you might, hearing this tale of the Dullahan, you might think, well, if this character comes riding around, I've got to see this. This sounds impressive. Well, you were advised not to. If he comes riding around, don't peek out through a crack in the door or the window because he has a whip. Sometimes it's said to be crafted from a human spinal column, and he will crack it at you, and if he catches your eyes, it'll blind you.
Ooh, why am I calling to mind like an evil version of Santa Claus who catches the children peeking on, you know, on Christmas?
It's kind of like that, you know? I mean, and I think we can all kind of relate to that idea of the supernatural. Like, it's one thing to hear tales of the supernatural, but then do you dare see it? Because once you've seen it, you've crossed over, right? You're no longer on this side of the stories. You're on the other side. And what does that mean for you? Mm. There are also tales that if he catches you looking, peeking out the door, he'll just ride up and throw a basin of blood in your face.
Oh,
yeah. but still, all that being said, like, he's still just riding by. The worst thing that could happen is that you'll hear those hoof falls stop. You'll hear that he has stopped outside your house, that he's lingering outside your house, which of course spells death for those inside or for someone inside. Like, he is not just passing through, he has arrived. Now, I wasn't able to find as many sources on this, but it is said that there is a modern Japanese urban legend variation of the Dullahan. The Kubanashi rider, or headless rider, doesn't ride a horse, but rides a motorcycle. The story is that his head was cut off by piano wire spanning a roadway, a detail that has been connected to the 1974 Australian outlaw biker film Stone, which was then released in Japan in 1981 and would have inspired this urban legend, apparently. I have not seen this one. I don't know if you're familiar with Stone.
No, I'm not familiar with it, but it sounds like a very Mad Max kind of detail.
Yeah, and in fact, it has Hugh Keyes Byrne in it, the guy who played Immortan Joe in the most recent Mad Max film, and also played what was like Toe Cutter, I think is his character, in the original Mad Max.
The villain in the first one and the fourth one, but different characters.
Yeah. Now, MacKillop also recounts a tale of a beheading game involving the hero Cuchulainn. Now, the beheading game, I think we've talked about this before on the show. This is a literary trope, perhaps best known for its place in Arthurian legend concerning the Green Knight. Basically, the game consists of this. You cut my head off, and then I cut yours off. Sounds like an easy contest until you realize that your opponent can get back up and walk around without a head, and will indeed be back to cut yours off later on.
This is central in the Arthurian story of Sir Gawain and the Green Knight. Sir Gawain is the one who answers the challenge. So the knights of the Round Table are feasting, I believe, on Christmas Day, or it's around Christmas. And the Green Knight, this man who is very much identified with nature and seems to be some kind of symbol of like paganism, this Green Knight figure comes in and he insults all of the knights and he challenges them to this game, this beheading game, and they're allowed to behead him first. So Sir Gawain, the young up and comer, is like, yeah, okay, I'll do it. Yeah. And he cuts the Green Knight's head off and the Green Knight is fine. He picks his own head up. He's like, okay, now I'll do that to you a year from now today. So you got to come find me at the Green Chapel. And so there's like, it's a morality story about honor and all that, that Sir Gawain is like, well, am I going to go do it? And he does.
Yeah, yeah. So there's a lot more to dissect there. But at heart, you do have a story of a headless, or at least temporarily headless, being.
I actually, Rachel and I just this past month watched for the first time that that recent Sir Gawain movie that they put out, Sir Gawain and the Green Knight. And I thought it was great.
Oh, cool. I haven't seen it yet, but I've heard great things. I've only ever watched the one in which Sean Connery plays the Green Knight.
Oh, no, I haven't seen that one.
Yeah, I think it's a pretty good Green Knight. Now, in looking around for other examples of headless beings, there's one I ran across that I wanted to bring up that it extends from Navajo or Dene traditions. Specifically, it's called the Thilgeth or Thilgeth. It's a form of Anye monster, sometimes translated, especially back in the early 20th century, as alien gods. I feel like that maybe that terminology could be confusing now. I'm not sure. But some sort of like gods from the outside, I guess. In her monster books, Carol Rose describes them as primal monsters, the offspring of wicked women who brought fear and misery into the world. The sons of sun and water, and I believe these are the Navajo hero twins, slayed these monsters. And according to Rose, their offspring, however, lived on, the monster's offspring lived on to keep cold, famine, old age, and poverty alive in the world, even if these like more primal fears had been defeated by the heroes.
Mm.
I was also reading that the monsters were slain by Naye Nezgani. This is a mythical hero from Navajo lore that is a monster slayer, and I believe is one of the Navajo twins referenced earlier. Gerald E. Levy, in his book, In the Beginning, the Navajo Genesis, lists the translated names of the monsters killed by the slayer as Big Ye, Horned Monster, Rock Monster Eagle, Kicks Off Rocks, and the Eye Killers. I believe Horned Monster is Thilgeth or Dilged, but there's no mention of headlessness here.
Hmm.
However, Dilged, Delgeth, or Thilgeth is listed as a quote-unquote hairy headless antelope on the website native-languages.org, which is a nonprofit dedicated to the preservation and promotion of endangered American Indian languages. So that leads me to believe, well, maybe this is some sort of headless entity, at least in some tellings.
Hmm. Hairy headless antelope. Interesting.
Yeah. So just another example that, you know, this idea of some sort of like headless entity, be it animal or human in form, like it's gonna touch a nerve. Like there is something unnatural and dreadful about it that we can't help but connect with monstrosity.
So I was looking for a good book that compiled stories about headless ghosts, and I found a chapter in a book by the well-known skeptic and paranormal investigator Joe Nickel called, the book is called The Science of Ghosts, Searching for Spirits of the Dead, published by Prometheus Books in 2012. And there's a chapter in this book called Headless Ghosts I Have Known. So at the beginning of this chapter, Nickel points out a few just kind of interesting contradictions, some of which I don't know if I've ever considered before. One is the idea that, you know, there are certain kinds of ghost realists, people who think that ghosts are real, independent external phenomena, and that certain of these ghost realists assert that a ghost is a form of physical energy peculiar to humans or perhaps to animals that survives death and remains in the environment. And yet, for some reason, ghosts are almost always perceived not only as manifestations of the human or animal body, but dressed as they might have been during life. So, like, if this energy exists and persists, it also seems to manifest inanimate objects, such as like clothing and uniforms and jewelry, other non-living objects that ghosts would sometimes carry with them.
That's a good point. Ghosts tend to wear clothes.
Along the same lines, some ideas about ghosts as real external phenomena explain them as some kind of lingering mental projection of the original person that persists after death, though this has interesting tension with the number of stories there are about headless ghosts, since mental phenomena are pretty well established to depend mostly on the brain. It would have to be a now-dead brain projecting not itself into the future, but some kind of three-dimensional representation of the part of the body that does not contain it, which is kind of interesting. But anyway, so those little observations aside, he goes on to document several types of stories of headless ghosts. In the United States, there are apparently a number of popular stories about soldiers from the American Civil War, like being decapitated by cannon fire and then wandering the battlefield forevermore as headless ghosts. He also mentions the various headless ghosts associated with the Tower of London in England, including several historical figures who were beheaded on the orders of Henry VIII, only a subset of which were his wives, the most famous of the Tower ghosts being Anne Boleyn, but there were also just some other enemies of Henry that end up there. But one of the stories that Nickel records that really stuck with me involves criminals in medieval Germany. So there is a place in the Rhine Valley called the Reichenstein Castle, where a legend says that a headless ghost sometimes wanders in the chapel adjoining the castle. And he describes a visit that he had to this castle to look into the legend. The origin story goes back to the 13th century, when this castle was the base of operations for a band of what he calls robber knights. I think, you know, fierce bandit horsemen. And then to quote from Nickel, and this is in part he is quoting from Dennis William Houck's International Dictionary of Haunted Places. So when the quote comes in, that's what it is. But Nickel writes, quote, "In 1282, they were captured, whereupon their leader, Dietrich von Hohenfels, entreated Emperor Rudolf von Habsburg to spare his nine sons. The emperor stated that Dietrich was to be beheaded, but with his sons lined in a row, everyone he could afterward run past would be spared. When the executioner's sword fell, quote, Dietrich's head rolled to the ground, but his bloodied torso stood erect and lunged forward, stumbling and swaying, until it passed every one of his sons. Finally, the headless body fell to its knees, a fountain of blood shooting high in the air where its head had been. The sons were spared, and afterward, on the execution site, the repentant family erected the St. Clement Chapel. According to Houck, Dietrich's headless ghost is sometimes seen inside the chapel. Also, quote, Dietrich is buried on the property, and his red sandstone marker depicts a knight in armor with no head." But Nickel points out that there are several issues with this story. So first of all, this grave marker described, wherever it is, it is now lost, or was at least at the time he was writing this book. Though there is an account of a visit to the site by Victor Hugo, where Hugo claimed that the grave marker was from the 14th century, not the 13th, and that Dietrich's name was not on it. Also, the account does not square with the history of the bandit knights at the castle, where apparently the more reliable sequence of facts seems to be that Dietrich actually escaped and his companions, the other robber knights, were in fact executed. They were hanged from trees in the Rhine Valley. And the basic outline of this folktale about Dietrich seems to go back in earlier form to a story about a 14th century German pirate and privateer named Klaus Störtebeker, who was captured and executed for his crimes in the year 1401. Nickel writes, quote, "Kneeling before the executioner, he proposed a deal. Quote, all those companions should be reprieved whom he could manage to walk by after being beheaded. This way he saved the lives of 11 pirates before the malicious executioner tripped him." That's a dirty trick.
Yeah. Now, this talk of headless privateers and so forth, of course, this brings to mind a modern retelling of this sort of story that I don't think we've mentioned so far. And that, of course, is Warren Zevon's 1978 song, Roland the Headless Thompson Gunner, which is an excellent song, wonderfully weird lyrics, a great ballad of headless being and revenge and so forth, but very much from this sort of vein, you know, instead of a pirate, an international mercenary.
Right. And so there are kind of like these story forms that just keep reappearing in stories about different people in different times and places in history. And Nickel ultimately thinks that the story about Dietrich that he came across is probably grafted from this original story about Stortebeker. But in either case, Nickel argues that the story is implausible. Like, it probably did not actually happen based on what we know about physiology. Like, you know, a chicken might be able to run around or walk around a bit after decapitation, but he does not think that a human would do the same.
Yeah, and it raises all sorts of questions about, well, how was he standing when the head was cut off? Like, how do you get ready for this attempted lurch across the execution yard to save other pirates?
That's a good question. I don't know the answer there. But one more tangent I went on from Nickel's book. Later in the book, there's a short section on ghost dogs where Nickel brings up the English legend, sometimes known as Black Shuck, a spectral hound with sort of localized incarnations or tellings in different regions of England, such as Devon, Essex, Suffolk, and Norfolk. And this ghost dog is said to have black hair and stand as large as a calf, quote, sporting glowing eyes, even when he is described as headless.
Mm.
And I loved that. The image of a canine body that has glowing eyes despite having no head. Now, can you have eyes if you have no head? Well, I think if you're a dog, the answer is probably no, at least plausibly no, without some kind of sci-fi Frankenstein thing going on. But if you're another kind of animal, the answer is absolutely. Yes, you can have eyes without a head. As weird as it sounds, there are animals exactly like that. Just one example I would like to briefly talk about are scallops. Oh, scallops, scallops. Which way do you say it, Rob?
Scallops? I guess.
Scallops. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. A little further back in the, yeah. Let's say scallops. Folks, if you are near a computer or are safely able to look at your phone right now, just do yourself a favor and look up scallop eyes. It's like something straight out of a monster movie. There are real unedited photos of scallop eyes that look like they cannot be from nature, but they are. So you will sometimes see the shell will be just slightly open. You know, it's mostly closed, but there's a gap in between. And the inside of the shell is lined with a tissue that just has these pale blue dots all along it, which clearly do read as eyes for some reason. They don't just look like dots. I mean, it looks like they're looking at you. And then in between that, there are these tissues that kind of lock together with these spiky hairs that looks like the world's widest monster mouth with infinite teeth.
Yeah, they're terrifying. They're so bright in some of these pictures too. They feel like it should be a Legend of Zelda enemy, you know?
Yes, that's really good. Yeah. Da, 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 da. Yeah, you can imagine the treasure chest popping up when you defeat the scallop. Hey, and if it's in one of the new Zelda games, surely you would end up getting to cook with the scallop from it, right?
That's right. I hear all about, I don't play the game myself, but my son does. And he tells me all about the different meats you cook. And then, of course, there's not just going to be one. There's going to be about eight different versions of it, right, with different head features.
Yeah, and you combine the body parts from the different ones to make different kinds of meals. That cooking mechanic is very pleasing. It's always a nice little surprise when you mix something new and it does make a dish. But anyway, scallops are interesting in that their visual anatomy differs substantially from ours. Scallops can, of course, have hundreds of eyes per organism. We only have two. And while our eyes use curved transparent lenses to focus light onto the retina, scallops focus light instead with tiny mirrors made of crystals of guanine. And if guanine's ringing a bell for you, yes, that is one of the four bases found in DNA. That's the one that pairs with cytosine. Strange fact I just learned while preparing for this episode, guanine gets its name from guano, as in like bat dung or bird dung, because the compound was found in great quantities in guano. But in its crystalline form, guanine, it forms the iridescent component in fish scales and other kind of pearly reflective surfaces in parts of animal bodies, sometimes in reptiles too. Like I believe chameleons, you know, have guanine. But in the case of scallops, scallop eyes focus light onto the light-sensitive cells, their equivalent of retinas, with reflective mirrors made of segmented guanine crystals. I think they're actually square-shaped crystal plates. And there's an interesting comparison to be made to technology, to human-made telescopes, because while the earliest telescopes, like those used by Galileo, used transparent glass lenses to focus light into the eyepiece, kind of like our eyes do, the most advanced telescopes today actually tend to use curved mirrors instead of lenses as the primary light-gathering surface.
Wow, that's incredible.
But if there's one thing I want you to take away from this, it's just go Google scallop eyes.
Yes, yes. These are amazing images. And it does feel like they're looking right at you.
Guess what, Mango?
What's that, Will?
So iHeart is giving us a whole minute to promote our podcast, Part-Time Genius.
I know. That's why I spent my whole week composing a haiku for the occasion. It's about my emotional journey in podcasting over the last 7 years, and it's called Earthquake House.
Mango, I'm going to cut you off right there. Why don't we just tell people about our show instead?
Yeah, that's a better idea. So every week on Part-Time Genius, we feed our curiosity by answering the world's most important questions. Things like, when did America start dialing 911? Is William Shatner's best acting work in Esperanto? Also, what happened to Esperanto?
Plus, we cover questions like, how Chinese is your Chinese food? How do dollar stores stay in business? And of course, is there an Illuminati of cheese?
There absolutely is, and we are risking our lives by talking about it. But if you love mind-blowing facts, incredible history, and really bad jokes, make your brains happy and tune in to Part-Time Genius.
Listen to Part-Time Genius on the iHeartRadio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
If you want to level up your marketing and business knowledge, then look no further than the Marketing School podcast hosted by Neil Patel and yours truly, Eric Hsu. It is the number one marketing podcast in the United States and number 15 on business in the United States. And it has amazing guests such as Alex Hormozi, Layla Hormozi, Cody Sanchez. We pull in these amazing interviews with other people that are not only great marketers, but actual operators. And the icing on the cake is Neil and myself were also operators as well. So we share learnings from the trenches. We share secrets that we otherwise wouldn't be sharing with other people. And we also share other advantages that will help you get ahead of your competition. So all you have to do is listen to Marketing School every weekday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey guys, I'm home.
Everyone knows that it's Dad's job to be a bit of a joker.
Sorry I'm late, everyone. There was an accident at the factory. Monty fell into the upholstery machine. Don't worry though, he's fully recovered.
Good one, Dad.
Did you get the pizza for dinner?
So he likes to keep everyone happy with some dad jokes.
Yep, right here. I had a coupon, and it saved me a lot of dough.
Well, the truth is, Dad is just a fun guy.
Hey, I'm not a mushroom.
Please stop. Where does he get these stupid jokes from?
He listens to the Daily Dad Jokes podcast.
Oh, great. More dad jokes for me.
We've delivered over 15,000 jokes to over 3 million listeners, and man, the postage fees are killing us. Listen to the Daily Dad Jokes podcast every day on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
All right. At this point in the episode, I want to turn back to this idea that we discussed a little bit in the last episode, this idea of headless creatures, but with faces on their chests. So we looked at some examples from like Chinese mythology and Hindu mythology, where you had creatures that have no head, but have, but the face is found a way. You know, the nipples have become eyeballs, and the belly is a great big mouth.
Mm-hmm.
The most famous Western versions of these, though, the versions of these sort of monstrous ideas, the ones that cast the longest shadow, are generally referred to, by various names, particularly by authors in antiquity, but then going on up through the Middle Ages and so forth. One of the names is the Blemmyes, another is the Acephali, which just means headless. But many of the names that were attributed to them were actual peoples, that were the names of actual peoples that were said to live in remote parts of the known world, or I guess more specifically, on the edges of what was the known world for the individuals creating maps, writing these various travel logs, and speculating about what sort of life and what sort of peoples there were on the far-flung corners of the world.
And while it's certainly possible that these stories could be based on, you know, misinterpreted or misreported observations, things like that that we'll get into, you also really can't help but notice that there would be a natural temptation when describing people who live like in the farthest place away from you that you can imagine, that maybe they are really different somehow, maybe like they don't even have heads.
Yeah. And that's basically the idea. Yeah. There were other monstrous races, to be sure. And you can find various illustrations of these in various books from the time periods in question. They include not only people with faces on their chests and no head, but also one-legged people that hop around on one leg and that sort of thing, the so-called monstrous races. But this idea goes way back. And yeah, we'll unwrap some of the ideas that have been put forth as to why these concepts emerged and why they had such stickiness in the human imagination. And I do think the human imagination, as always, should be, we should keep that in mind as being one of the primary factors here. Like people thinking about, again, like thinking about the edge of the world, thinking about other planets. We're dealing with sort of a gray area where we can just inject pure imagination. But then on top of that, there's the normal telephone game of translations and accounts and some other factors we'll get into.
Mm-hmm.
So the Greeks called them the Acephali or the Headless Ones. They were also known again as the Blemmyes, which was the name given to an actual people who seemed to have lived in Lower Nubia during the 7th century BCE through the 8th century CE. So to be clear, the actual people that lived there had heads and were not monsters. They were people. This is the idea that gets passed down through these various writings. Herodotus indirectly mentions the Acephali in the 5th century BCE work, Histories, among other exaggerated foreign peoples with inhuman descriptions. He refers to, quote, the headless men that have their eyes in their chests. During the 1st century CE, Pliny the Elder wrote about them as well in the Natural History, referring to them among other exaggerated and or, strange accounts of supposed foreign peoples in the far flung corners of the world, writing, quote, in translation, of course, the Blemmyes are said to have no heads, their mouths and eyes being seated in their breasts. And you'll find various accounts like this repeated through the Middle Ages and into the Age of Discovery. You can look at works such as The Travels of Sir John Mandeville, the writings of Sir Walter Raleigh, and so forth. They are just more numerous to mention here in this episode.
To be clear, you're saying some of the other, these like medieval travel writings described people with implausible anatomy that were, you know, this is not really how people's bodies were, but for some reason in some place, these authors would say, yeah, there are people here who they don't have a head or they have one leg or something.
Yeah. And I gather that, you know, there are a mix of things going on here. On one level, it's like, well, Pliny the Elder wrote about it, so we're going to repeat that. Of course, you know, Pliny, as we've discussed in the show, Pliny has a lot of interesting things to share, some of which have truth, have an element of truth to them, or are, you know, accounts of what's happening in the real world. Others are things that he heard and were passed down and don't relay any historic truth, but do tell us something about, like, the mindset of the time.
Mm-hmm.
Now, before we get back into the question of where these stories came from and what they may have originally meant, you know, what things could have led to these interpretations and tales, I think it's also worthwhile to think about their staying power and usefulness in conveying different meanings. some but not all of which relate to a general monsterization of the other. And again, I think it's also one of those things where it's imaginative and weird enough, and that alone is a reason that people keep coming back to it. And just sort of like some of the ideas we discussed in the first episode, like we think about creatures with heads and we take it for granted, and then you're presented with a form that's lacking a head, but it's still alive. Like, what does it mean? You can't help but interpret, have these various symbolic interpretations of metaphoric interpretations of what's going on there.
Mm-hmm.
So I was looking around for some insight on this general topic. As pointed out by Husband and Gilmore House in The Wild Man, Medieval Myth and Symbolism, you had cases like that of 13th century Flemish writer Thomas de Contemporary, who compared such headless men to lawyers who quote, misled clients into unnecessary legal processes and grew fat on inordinate fees. I love that because I can't help but imagine one of these various lawyer billboards you see everywhere on the highways. But instead of having that, you know, smiling dude in a suit, what if you had a belly faced man on them?
What if Bob Odenkirk's face was on his chest?
Yeah. Exactly, yeah. Husband and Gilmore House also point out that the headless man has also been presented as an image of humility. This is apparently from the 13th or 14th century text, Gesta Romanorum. I consulted this text and I did find the line I think they're referring to. Quote, humility is signified by the absence of the head and the placing of the face in the breast. The text also includes this bit of wisdom. No creature is so monstrous, no fable so incredible, but that the monkish writers could give it a moral form and extract from its crudities and quiddities some moral or religious lesson.
This comes back to something we've talked about on the show before, that that a lot of times when you get these older accounts, especially in, say, like a medieval Christian context of anomalous beings, they were almost always in the texts where they're documented used to illustrate some kind of moralistic teaching. And that should in some way color your understanding of like what purpose these stories were serving.
Yeah. Yeah. This idea of taking a monstrous form, using it to relay a point, or as this quote is kind of alluding to, like, it's like the monk cannot help when presented with a strange form to come up with some sort of theological argument for what it represents.
Yeah.
One example that I've brought up on the show before is this creature that shows up in some medieval sources. Sorry, I don't remember the sources offhand, but I've referred to it in a monster fact before, of Christ with a long neck and bird's head. And the idea here, I remember reading, is that it's like, be more like Christ, be more like an individual with a long neck and a bird's head, because then the words that rise up from your heart, well, they have longer to, they have more distance to cover before they reach your lips, before you can speak them. And therefore, it is wise and Christ-like to approach the world this way and so forth, you know. But then on the other end, it's just an amusing looking illustration as well, because It's clearly supposed to be Jesus, but he has a bird's head.
You know, just raises questions where I realize that my intuitions are about what somebody would or would not consider sacrilegious are not always correct.
Yeah. Yeah. There's so many examples of that. Just depictions of Christ, like the three-faced Christ that you saw that was sometimes used as a way to describe some aspect of the Holy Trinity, but also was then viewed as potentially heretical by others and so forth. Anyway, coming back to the idea of creatures with no heads and faces on their torso, I guess one of the big questions that comes to mind looking at these images is, you know, where does this idea even come from? Because it's one thing to realize that once the idea is introduced, it has a stickiness to it. We can't help but think about it and come up with reasons for why it could be or what it means. And looking around, there seem to be a number of theories, some convincing, some far less convincing. And it's, as always, it's one of these cases where I feel like you could cobble various ideas together and possibly get at some truth, though I would be very hesitant to take even the better theories and lean too heavily on them as like an all-inclusive theory. Like, this is the reason somebody described people on a distant continent as having no head and having a face on their chest. So the first theory I wanted to bring up, and this is when you've seen a number of sources, is the idea that these would have been essentially accounts based on limited observation of certain groups of people, certain tribes or whatnot, from a distance, such as from a ship off of a foreign coast. And, you know, I imagine this alone, without the aid of spyglasses, could potentially be enough. But then the idea is that this could have been compounded by modes of dress, such as, you know, something worn on the head, or specifically the use of some sort of a hood.
Hmm.
From a distance, it was apparently argued by 17th century German author Adam Olearius and others that hooded figures might conceivably be interpreted as headless. So if you had a group of people that traditionally wore some sort of headgear, a hood or what have you, then from a distance you might say, hey, look at those people standing on that shore. They appear to have no head. Write it down. Maybe draw a picture. We'll bring that back at the end of the voyage.
Okay, I could imagine that. But along the same lines as somebody seeing and misinterpreting clothing or adornment of the body, you would also have to wonder about somebody seeing and misinterpreting somebody with just a particular posture.
Yeah, and that's one you read about as well. In fact, John Bostock and H.T. Riley chime in on this in their liner notes to their translation of Pliny's Natural History. Something you might think of is, I think of it as like the warrior stance theory here. And basically they point out, quote, from a statement in the Ethiopica of Heliodorus, Marcus suggests that the story as to the Blemmyi having no heads arose from the circumstance that on the invasion of the Persians, they were in the habit of falling on one knee and bowing the head to the breast, by which means, without injury to themselves, they afforded a passage to the horses of the enemy. Now, I have to admit, that is a sentence I do not fully understand exactly what they're describing there, but I take it to mean that there's some sort of like a uniform posture that certain individuals were said to take on as some sort of like a defensive posture, a warrior stance, or what have you, that could be interpreted even from, you know, from a distance as being people with no head.
I guess you could imagine a similar thing being that somebody without experience of seeing warriors in a phalanx formation might say, oh, wow, these people, you know, they have 100 legs and 100 spear arms, and they're one massive organism, because you're unfamiliar with the way that they're grouping their bodies and what they're doing.
Yeah. Now, that leads to another, I think, important thing here is again, coming back to that telephone game of accounts and the idea of one source speaking, not speaking literally about something, and then it being interpreted as a literal description of something. So you can imagine somebody saying, yes, it was like they were this beast with 100 feet and a shell all around them. And then, you know, at the end of the telephone game of accounts, someone is saying they literally use large insects in their battles.
Uh-huh.
And so you see some variations on that with dissection of the headless entity. For instance, 17th century Danish physician Thomas Bartholin argued that it was a metaphor that ends up being taken literally, in that the people described were, for one reason or another, thought to be headless in the non-literal sense. So perhaps they couldn't be reasoned with, or they otherwise conducted themselves in a, you know, a difficult to understand fashion, what have you. And then it just gets translated into, oh, yes, and they had no heads.
So what begins maybe as more like a metaphorical, ethnocentric derogation of some other group of people turns in, is misinterpreted as a literal statement about their bodies.
Right. So a lot of these interpretations are also like essentially saying, okay, clearly these are not creatures that exist, but there has to be some middle ground. There has to be something kind of like it. And you see a number of these that I think you could classify as sunken head theories. The idea that you wouldn't be dealing with someone with a face on their chest, but what if you had a group of people that had, for one reason, one hypothetical reason or another, a greatly shortened neck or even a seeming absence of a neck?
So assuming that, I guess giving more credence to the original claims as saying, like, well, they really did see some people who they were describing in a more reliable fashion than whatever we were just talking about. But there's some there's some explanation for it. I'm often skeptical of attempts to explain historical claims like this, but let's see what they say.
Well, a lot of it ends up coming down to situations where you had individuals like 18th century Jesuit naturalist Lafaton. There's also Johannes de Laet, a 17th century geographer. And basically, like, a lot of their arguments come down to the same thing, saying, okay, well, here's this thing in these travel logs and these accounts. And look here, we have evidence, we have accounts of people with some sort of a sunken head situation. Like, and some of these seem to be more on the, in the along the lines of, well, here are some individuals with really thick necks, or they have, you know, more highly developed muscles that, yeah, you could lean into some description of them having a sunken head or less of a neck. But I don't know, it seems kind of a flimsy argument to make. I mean, likewise, you'll see allusions to various congenital conditions where a person will be born with fused neck bones or a shortened neck. Accounts of this from the ancient world are known. I think there are even some controversial theories that King Tut could have had some variation on one of these syndromes, but there are a whole host of theories as to what may or may not have been going on with his personal health.
Yeah, I'm not exactly sure why, but I'm intuitively a little more skeptical of explanations like this for where these claims came from.
Yeah, and then likewise, you have other examples where people are bringing up birth defects and various, again, congenital abnormalities that, are generally cases where the individual would not survive. And you're not even talking about an individual in this scenario. You're talking about the idea that there's a whole group of people or beings out there that all have the same appearance, that all have some sort of a shortened neck or sunken head scenario going on.
Guess what, Bango?
What's that, Will?
So iHeart is giving us a whole minute to promote our podcast, Part-Time Genius.
I know. That's why I spent my whole week composing a haiku for the occasion. It's about my emotional journey in podcasting over the last 7 years, and it's called Earthquake House.
Mango, I'm going to cut you off right there. Why don't we just tell people about our show instead?
Yeah, that's a better idea. So every week on Part-Time Genius, we feed our curiosity by answering the world's most important questions. Things like, when did America start dialing 911? Is William Shatner's best acting work in Esperanto? Also, what happened to Esperanto?
Plus, we cover questions like, how Chinese is your Chinese food? How do dollar stores stay in business? And of course, is there an Illuminati of cheese?
There absolutely is, and we are risking our lives by talking about it. But if you love mind-blowing facts, incredible history, and really bad jokes, make your brains happy and tune into Part-Time Genius.
Listen to Part-Time Genius on the iHeartRadio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
If you want to level up your marketing and business knowledge, then look no further than the Marketing School podcast hosted by Neil Patel and yours truly, Eric Hsu. It is the number one marketing podcast in the United States and number 15 on business in the United States. And it has amazing guests such as Alex Hormozi, Layla Hormozi, Cody Sanchez. We pull in these amazing interviews with other people that are not only great marketers, but actual operators. And the icing on the cake is Neil and myself were also operators as well. So we share learnings from the trenches. We share secrets that we otherwise wouldn't be sharing with other people. And we also share other advantages that will help you get ahead of your competition. So all you have to do is listen to Marketing School every weekday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey guys, I'm home.
Everyone knows that it's Dad's job to be a bit of a joker.
Sorry I'm late, everyone. There was an accident at the factory. Monty fell into the upholstery machine. Don't worry though, he's fully recovered.
Good one, Dad.
Did you get the pizza for dinner?
So he likes to keep everyone happy with some dad jokes.
Yep, right here. I had a coupon, and it saved me a lot of dough.
Well, the truth is, Dad is just a fun guy.
Hey, I'm not a mushroom.
Please stop. Where does he get these stupid jokes from?
He listens to the Daily Dad Jokes podcast.
Oh, great. More dad jokes for me.
We've delivered over 15,000 jokes to over 3 million listeners, and man, the postage fees are killing us. Listen to the Daily Dad Jokes podcast every day on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Now, another source I was looking at here was 1924's The Coasts of Illusion, a study of travel tales by author Carl B. Firestone. He brings up an argument made by 18th century French naturalist Georges Louis L. Buffon, who says, well, what we could be looking at here are reports of body modification. Buffon apparently compared it to certain known practices of neck and head elongation that you see in some groups. So I guess this argument is based a little bit in fact, but also I really can't put a lot of faith in this argument. Like, yes, well, there are cases where people have elongated the structure of the head or done, body modification of the neck or shoulders. I think more specifically the shoulders than the neck. But it's a stretch to go from there to the idea of people like pushing their head down into their body.
Yeah, that doesn't makes sense to me. I mean, I can imagine a lot more somebody doing a body modification that could make it look like they had a face in their torso than that would could make it look like they didn't have a head on their shoulders.
Yeah. Oh, another example. This one kind of goes back to what we were just talking about earlier with warriors and warrior stances. In The Monstrous Races in Medieval Art and Thought, author John Block Friedman discusses the possibility that shields with faces on them or some sort of face-like motif on chest wear or armor might have also given this impression. So, I mean, that's another case where, again, it may be one instance of this being observed and then it gets, the story gets told, it gets translated, it gets passed on, and it becomes people with faces on their chest.
Yeah, again, that somehow seems to be the kind of thing that feels more plausible to me, that it would, that it could be a misinterpretation seeing from a distance of, or a misinterpretation of the original report of certain appearances of like shields or armor or clothing that could look like a face on the body.
Yeah. Now, another possible theory here is the, you might think of as the primate theory. And that's the idea that what we're really looking at here are very distorted descriptions of chimpanzees or bonobos rather than human beings. And interestingly enough, this was actually cited in the 19th century by none other than Captain Sir Richard Francis Burton. He speaks of the, quote, savage exaggeration of ape sightings, saying, specifically pointing out the Blemiers as being the kind of thing that, okay, well, this is just based on somebody exaggerating a sighting they made of an ape, a bonobo, a chimpanzee, or something like that. And you can, I've seen some examples too where people will bring up photographs of chimps or bonobos and point to like the stance, the sort of basic body morphology of the primate in question, and say like, well, if you're looking at it from the right angle, this could lead into an interpretation of a creature with without a head, or a creature even with a face positioned somewhere in the torso.
That you could understand how you could see an ape and imagine maybe at a certain posture that its head was lower than it was. It's hard to imagine how that could be mistaken for like a people living in a certain land.
Yeah. So like I say, any one of these theories, I think, is not strong enough to support the general principle here. I feel like inevitably you're dealing with a whole lot of different ideas and just in general, like the stickiness of the concept once it's been introduced, where people just continue to repeat it, even if logically they think, well, this probably isn't possible. And of course, no matter which idea you end up gravitating to, or if you reject all of them, there's still something undeniable about all of these stories, and that there is just an undeniable xenophobic and racist nature of depicting the people of foreign lands as monsters or something monster-like, as something less than and different from human beings. Earlier, I referred in passing to the Age of Discovery, but of course, it wasn't just an age of discovery. It was an age of conquest and exploitation, and you know, the wages of which have never ceased. And so this is very much a part of any rational analysis of this scenario. I found a very good source on this that was discussing this, Monstrous Alterity in Early Modern Travel Accounts. This was published in 2008 from the journal L'Esprit Créateur, or the Creative Spirit. And in it, in this particular article, author Lynn Ramey links these accounts of belly-mouthed and one-legged beings to broader theological discussions about whether or not the occupants of foreign lands were truly human with souls. Quote, "Eventually and inevitably, Augustine's ambiguous conclusion that the monstrous races either were men and should be saved or were not men became untenable. Augustine might well suggest that Blemier and Scyopods, or one-legged men, are questionably human based on their physical bodies, but the inhabitants of the Americas resembled very much their conquerors. Apologists for Christian colonialists came to the conclusion that they were in fact men without souls, born from spontaneous generation but not descended from Adam. Equating some ethnic groups with soulless animals lifted the onus of conversion from the colonists and easily justified oppression and exploitation, unfortunately proving to be a line of thought that unfortunately proved extremely difficult to eradicate."
Yeah, and I sense that there's a kind of uncomfortable thing that's all throughout reading these accounts of people with these impossible bodies, even going back to, you know, accounts from the ancient world where it wasn't necessarily part of an explicit attempt to justify colonial enterprise. Mm-hmm. Even in those cases, you can just sense a kind of a lack of a universal sense of humanity. Yeah. You know, there's this kind of feeling that, like, well, whatever those other people are living very far away, you know, I don't know if they're even really beings like we are. In fact, here are even some strange claims about their bodies that could not possibly be true. And so that just kind of leads to this suggestion that, like, well, I don't know, people from far away are not really people. So anyway, I don't know. There's a quality that's always just made me feel a little uneasy when reading these accounts of, like, men with faces in their torsos and stuff like that, that isn't really there for, like, the gods and fantastical beings, but these ancient accounts about alleged peoples of this kind. And I guess I didn't always know exactly what it was that made me feel that way, but I guess it is some kind of implicit understanding of this, that it is a way of questioning the full humanity of peoples elsewhere.
Yeah, because if you populate the edges of your known world with monsters, well, then it's more appropriate that you go out and exploit and conquer those lands, right? As alluded to in that quote, you don't have any kind of spiritual obligation to those people because in your view they're not people, and so forth. All right. Well, did we stick the landing on a nice, depressing finish to these episodes on headless creatures and fantasy and fiction and mythology and legend and so forth?
I guess so. That's a sad place to end, but an important thing to understand.
Yeah. I have to admit, the examples from the last episode are definitely more fun, where you just have a situation where some sort of a divine being gets into a fight with a god or an argument with a god and just has their head stoved in or has their head cut off by a god, but then their body finds a way to manifest a face, manifest nipple eyes and a big gaping mouth in the belly. Or even these ideas that we discussed in this episode of, like, the headless Avengers, you know, the Roland the Thompson Gunner's head is gone, but still he keeps going. The, you know, headless horsemen, they have no head anymore, and yet the body continues. There's some sort of, like, level of volition that is still burning in these mythological, folkloric, and fictional beings that can't be extinguished even by removing the head, a thing that we all know is the definite end of any mortal being.
Also, please look up scallops and their 200 Betty Davis eyes.
That's right. Look up the scallops. All right, we're going to go ahead and close this episode out, but we'd love to hear from everyone out there. Just a reminder that Stuff to Blow Your Mind is primarily a science podcast with core episodes on Tuesdays and Thursdays, listener mail on Mondays, short form Monster Fact or Artifact on Wednesdays. And on Fridays, we set aside Most Serious Concerns to just talk about a weird film on Weird House Cinema. If you use social media, follow us, look us up. We are STBYM Podcast on Instagram. If you use Facebook, there's the discussion module there. Seek it out. It's a Facebook group. Ask to join. If you can guess the name of this podcast, you can get in. And if you can't, you don't belong there anyway. And if you use Discord, there's also a Discord channel. I forget what the terminology is, but we're on there. Server? Yeah.
Server?
If you would like to be in that Discord server or whatever we're supposed to call it, just shoot us an email and we will send you the link.
Huge thanks, as always, to our excellent audio producer, JJ Posway. If you would like to get in touch with us with feedback on this episode or any other, to suggest a topic for the future, or just to say hello, you can email us at contact@stufftoblowyourmind.com.
Stuff to Blow Your Mind is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
Guess what, Will?
What's that, Mango?
I've been trying to write a promo for our podcast, Part-Time Genius, but even though we've done over 250 episodes, we don't really talk about murders or cults.
I mean, we did just cover the Illuminati of cheese, so I feel like that makes us pretty edgy. We also solve mysteries like how Chinese is your Chinese food and how do dollar stores make money? And then, of course, can you game a dog show?
So what you're saying is everyone should be listening.
Listen to Part-Time Genius on the iHeartRadio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Big Take from Bloomberg News brings you what's shaping the world's economies with the smartest and best-informed business reporters around the world.
We cover the stories behind what's moving money and markets and help you understand what's happening, what it means, and why it matters every afternoon. I'm Sarah Holder.
I'm Saleha Mohsen.
And I'm David Gura. Listen to The Big Take on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Black Effect presents Family Therapy, and I'm your host, Elliot Connie. Jay is the woman in this dynamic who is currently co-parenting two young boys with her former partner, David.
David, he is a leader. He just don't want to leave me.
But how do you lead a woman? How do you lead in a relationship? Like, what's the blueprint?
David, you just asked the most important question. Listen to Family Therapy on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.